Hello everybody, this is Kyle, and today we'll be reading chapter 3. It's called D-Day. Alright, so let's get started. Fafoom, D flinched and ducked. One of the big American destroyers behind his Higgins boat fired all its guns at once, chilling the German defenses on shore. The huge shells felt like a freight train roaring past. Battleships up and down the line fired again and again, their muzzles flashing bright orange in the darkness. The Higgins boat plowed ahead through the waves, and even though it was summer, D was cold. The sea spray in the water at the bottom of the boat froze him to the bone. He hugged himself and crouched low, staring at the green metal helmets of the soldiers in front of him. Nobody spoke. You've had to yell to be heard over the motor, in the ocean, and the battleships, and the planes droning by overhead. Most everybody was lost in their own thoughts anyway. The thought of his parents, his mother, a thin woman with blonde hair who worked as an illustrator for a pattern design company. His father, a short, balding man who managed a food warehouse. His parents had left behind everything they knew and everyone they loved to get the out of the Nazi Germany. They'd learned a new language and started new lives and made a new home for their son. Would he ever see them again? Dee felt a tear run down his cheek. He pretended to wipe away the sea spray as he dragged himself, his sleeve across his face. "Hey," said to Dee, yelling right in his ear to be heard. "It's D-Day. Get up. Get it. Get it? D-Day? This is your day. D. That means you gotta make it through. Okay?" Despite the sick feeling in his stomach, D smiled. Every time the U.S. Army started a mission, the first day was called D-Day. That's what the D stood for. It meant D-Day-Day for starting day. There had been plenty of other D-Days before, but this was the big one, and all the soldiers knew it, the D-Day. And D liked the idea of this one being D-Day, his day. His day. It kind of was, after all, it was D's day for atonement, the day he came back to Europe to undo what his family had allowed to happen 11 years ago. Today was a culmination of events that had been set in motion that night Uncle Otto had disappeared. D heard a scream like the squeal of a radio overhead, and he looked up. A cloud of rockets shoot past, fire and smoke drawing orange and gray streaks across the sky. The rockets went on and on and on, hundreds of them, thousands. D and his platoon mates looked around at each other and wondered this was something new. Boom! Boom, boom, boom. D heard the rockets explode up ahead beyond the 7-foot-tall ramp at the front of their boat. Sid smiled at D as if to say, what could be left for us to fight after that? But the grim expressions on the faces of the veterans around them dulled D's baptism at the front of the boat. Sergeant Taylor turned to yell at them. "All right, you louts. This is it," he shouted. "This isn't just an invasion of France. It's a toehold in Europe. The first step in pushing Jerry's all the way back to Berlin. We're the foot in the door, the wrench in the works, the kick in Hitler's nuts." Dee sat up straighter, listening closely. "I don't have to yell you how big this is," the sergeant continued. "You've seen it. All the years of planning by the mucky mucks in Washington and London. All the ships, planes, tanks, all the pilots and spies and paratroopers and artillerymen and sailors and medics. Who did their part so we could be where we are? Right here. Right now. Standing in a puddle of our own sick with Normandy and all of Europe. Right behind this ramp. Everything's come together for this one moment. And now it's all down to us. So don't screw it up." "Great pep talk, Sergeant," Dee thought as the Higgins boat shuddered and bumped. The engine slowed. Sid put his helmet to Dee's helmet and blowed in his big, deep voice. "Don't worry, buddy. We're going to get through to this together." Then the boat hit the beach and the ramp fell down on history. All right, so today this is going to be a bonus. So this is Operation Tortoise, June 6, 1944, 6 hours before the beach invasion, near Villers, Bocage, France. The dice. This is chapter 4. The dice are on the carpet. A door slammed in the sleepy French village, making 11-year-old Samara Zidane jump. She gripped her mother's hand tighter as they hurried along the road out of town. Her mother squeezed back. "I'm scared too," the squeeze told her, "but we'll get through this together." Samara's mother, Kenza Zidane, wore a tan raincoat and a blue kerchief, doing her best to hide her beauty in her black hair and light brown skin. Samara and her mother were French, Algerian, and the Nazis weren't tolerant of anyone who didn't match their white-skinned, blonde-haired, Aryan idol. Samara wished she'd brought a kerchief to hide her hair and face too, but she'd gotten dressed too quickly and wore just a simple green dress and brown sweater. Samara searched for the full moon in the sky, but clouds covered it, making the road beyond the village dark and full shadows. It wasn't quiet though. Night was never quiet in this part of northern France. Not since the German occupation began. Night after night, American and English planes droned overhead, dropping bombs on Normandy's bigger cities. Samara had heard that Caen, Vire, and Lisieux were more rubble than buildings now. The Germans refusing to take the beating without a fight rattled anti-aircraft guns at the bombers, drawing brilliant white lines across the sky like fireworks. Samaria and her mother needed the noise in the darkness. It was well after curfew. When no one was allowed to be on the streets but soldiers, if you were caught out after curfew, you were automatically arrested and thrown into jail. If you were lucky, Samaria had seen Germans shoot people as spies just for being out late. And that's what Samaria's mother was, a spy for the French resistance. Samaria herself wasn't a spy, but she was a convenient prop. If caught, they would have practiced story that Samaria was kicked and Kenza was taking her to a doctor. That was why they were out so late that night and couldn't wait until morning. The Nazis were unlikely to be sympathetic. But at least it was a realistic excuse for why they were out when they shouldn't be. And a woman with an 11-year-old girl in tow was far less likely to be accused of being a spy. Samara's mother pulled her along by the hand, her eyes scanning every inch of the road and the fields. They had been out after curfew before, and it was always dangerous. But if ever there was a night to take the risk, this was it. That evening, during the nightly BBC radio broadcast from England, Samaria and her mother had heard the words of all of France had been waiting to hear, "Le dix sont sur le pis, elle fait chada souves." The dice are on the carpet. It's hot in Suez. There were code words on the carpet. Oh, they were meaningless to the Germans, but they meant everything to the French resistance. The scattered groups of citizens who had taken up arms and were hiding out in the forest, mountains, and villages fighting a guerrilla war against the Nazi occupation. The code words meant that the Allied forces were invading France at last. And it was the job of Samaria and her mother to take that message to the resistance fighters south of their little town of Villers-Bocage as they hurried toward the woods. Were there, Samaria remembered another desperate night journey with her mother, their escape from Paris 4 years ago. Millions of Parisians had left the city in the days before the Nazis rolled in. But Samaria's family had stayed. Her parents were students from Algeria at the University of Paris, and they had nowhere else to go. Samaria had watched in horror as the Nazi soldiers goose-stepped their way down the Champs. Elysees. Paris's famous avenue of shops, theaters, and cafes. The Nazis had hung their swastika flag from the Arc de Triomphe and smiled. And filled the Parisian cafes like they were on a holiday. Samaria's parents were in the favor of Algerian citizens. from France. But with the Nazis in control, they knew that dream would never come true. So in 1940, Samaria's father had taken a part in a student protest against the German occupation, but the Nazis did not take kindly to protests. In the massacre that followed, German soldiers killed. Samaria had been just 7 years old, fearing for their lives. Samaria's mother had fled with her from Paris into the countryside, aided by a fledgling resistance group made up of former students turned rebels. Here, among the farms in hedgerows of more Normandy, using false papers to hide their identities. Samaria and her mother had survived. They had worked as messengers for the resistance ever since. Samaria and her mother were almost in the woods when they heard shouting and crying from up the road. Samaria's heartbeat quickened, troubled. Here in the countryside, this late at night, Samaria and her mother ducked into the cover of blueberry bushes beside the road. They crept along until they saw a group of farmhouses where French families were being dragged from their homes and loaded into trunks at gunpoint by soldiers. Nazi soldiers, Samaria watched the raid from the shadows, her pulse pounding in her ears. "When will you learn?" a Nazi officer said to the French farmers in heavily accented French. "For every one of us you kill, 100 of you will die. This must be retaliation for the killing of Major Vajel," Samaria's mother whispered. The Nazi officer had been murdered by the French resistance less than a day ago. "I've told them not to do that. They'll only send another Nazi big wig, and we always pay heavily for it." "But he did anything," cried one of the old men being dragged from his home. "None of us was responsible." Samaria knew it didn't matter. This was standard operating procedure for the Nazis. If one of their men was assassinated, they took their revenge by rounding up 100 of the local French citizens, executing them publicly. Her heart went out to the French farmers. None of this was their fault, but they were the ones being punished. A flash of movement behind one of the farmhouses caught Samaria's attention. "Look," she whispered. "Look," she whispered to her mother, pointing. A woman was lifting her young children out of a ground floor window to escape from the Nazis. "We have to help her," Samaria's mother said. She was already standing to go to the woman's aid. But what about the radio message?" Samaria asked. What if we're caught?" "We're in the resistance, Samaria," her mother told her. "We resist." And that was chapter 3 and chapter 4, you guys. Alright, so I'm sorry if I was, what's it called, like, misplacing my words and stuff. But, I'll see you on the next episode. And I hope you like this. And make sure you subscribe to my mom, Release from the Grips of Fear. And I'll see you on the next episode, you guys. Peace.